I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. If you want to reduce your impact on climate change, you can start by thinking about what's for dinner.
And it turns out there's a lot we can do in the kitchen.
That's Chef Kathy Caton-Grazzini. She says the biggest step people can take is to eat less meat, because producing it creates a lot of planet-warming pollution. So her new cookbook, Love the Foods That Love the Planet, includes dozens of vegetarian recipes, like arugula pesto, eggplant zucchini torte, and beet burgers. But even vegetarian ingredients have some impact on the climate. So the book includes a breakdown of the carbon pollution associated with key ingredients, and it explains where those emissions come from, whether it's farming, processing, or transport.
What's really driving emissions? Is it deforestation? Is it agricultural inputs like fertilizer or irrigation?
For some ingredients, like cocoa, the way they're produced matters a lot. So the book helps people learn how to identify more sustainably produced options,
so they can make smart decisions, informed decisions about the food we eat.
She hopes the book helps people better understand the impact their food choices have on the climate and inspires them to make wonderful meals that are better for the planet.
It's a delicious way to really make a difference.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
But in fact, this is a class society, and you could start a history of the United States with that sentence, the history of the United States is a history of class struggle. And it would be absolutely accurate. But can you imagine somebody writing, let's say, a textbook on American history for our very vulnerable students and starting off talking about our history being a history of class struggle? Can you imagine any major publisher publishing a book like that with that first sentence? Would it take very long for the publisher to go through that manuscript before rejecting it? And yet, it is an absolutely true statement.
That's Howard Zinn, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Howard Zinn on a people's history of the United States, part two of a special two-part program. You want to read a real history book? Matt Damon asks Robin Williams in the movie Good Will Hunting. Read Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. That book will knock you on your ass. Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States has sold more than 2 million copies, and it keeps on selling. His close friend Noam Chomsky said, "The book changed the consciousness of a generation." Zinn's history from below was to foreground, as he said, the countless small actions of unknown people. It was a sharp departure from the traditional focus on great men, presidents, generals, leaders, etc. His unorthodox approach presented the past stripped of its myths and propaganda. Howard Zinn, professor emeritus at Boston University, was perhaps this country's premier radical historian. He was born in Brooklyn in 1922. His parents, poor immigrants, were constantly moving to stay, as he once told me, one step ahead of the landlord. After high school, he went to work in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. During World War II, he saw combat duty as an Air Force bombardier. After the war, he went to Columbia University on the GI Bill. He was an active figure in the civil rights movement. He was among the first to oppose U.S. aggression in Indochina. A principled opponent of imperialism and militarism, he was an advocate of nonviolent civil disobedience. He spoke and marched against the U.S. wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Always ready to lend a hand, he believed in and practiced solidarity. Witty, erudite, generous, and loved by many the world over, Howard Zinn, friend and teacher, passed away in 2010. This archival program was recorded at Reed College in Portland, Oregon. And now, Howard Zinn.
As you know, the Founding Fathers were not a multicultural group. No women, no Native Americans, no blacks, and virtually no poor people. There was a 55, 53 maybe, 53 and a half rich white men who, as Charles Beard put it rightly, despite all the criticism he took for saying this, reflected the interests of the propertied classes. A strong central government was set up to protect the interests of the slave owners and the interests of the merchants and the interests of the bondholders. A country that would be able to move westward and protect the people who moved westward, who expanded into Indian lands. A government that would be able to send an army out into the Indian lands and get rid of the Indians and clear the way for white people to take over that land. Next time you hear somebody say, we mustn't have big government, this country was founded on the idea of big government. The slave owners needed big government, the manufacturers needed big government, the bondholders needed big government, the expanders needed big government. They all wanted desperately to have big government. And the rich and elite in this country have always wanted big government. Only recently, relatively recently in this century, have they worried about what big government may do. Because big government, for most of our history, has been big government on behalf of the wealthy interests. We've had a welfare state in this country for a very long time, but most of the welfare was given to powerful and rich corporations. It wasn't called welfare, you see. And the railroads in the 1850s got something like 20 million acres of land free from the states. During the Civil War, the railroads got something like 100 million acres of land free from the federal government. 100 million acres free? You try to get an acre of land. One, just tell the government you want just a little bit of land. 1 acre. They did it for the Union Pacific. They can do it for me, you know. This was welfare on an enormous scale. Subsidies to the merchant marine, subsidies to the manufacturers by increasingly higher tariffs, which are, of course, subsidies to the manufacturers and higher prices for the consumer. In 1931, Charles Beard, that same rascal who wrote about an economic interpretation of the Constitution, wrote an article called 31, remember, the midst of the Depression. And there's an argument about should the government do anything to help the poor, should we leave it to private charities? He wrote an article called The Myth of Rugged Individualism, because all the people were saying, we mustn't help all these people who don't have jobs anymore and who can't feed their families. In this country, we have a tradition. People have always made it on their own. And what Beard was asking was, did Rockefeller really make it on his own? Did Vanderbilt, did Harriman, did they really make it on their own? Did Carnegie and the steel industry really, did they make it on their own? And he listed in this article all the subsidies and all the grants that had been given by the federal government to the great corporations. The history of legislation in this country is a history of class legislation. Legislation is rarely talked about in class terms. It's talked about as if all the laws that are passed apply equally to everybody. Like they will say, taxes are raised, taxes are lowered. Do you want a tax hike or do you want taxes lowered? Well, it's kind of a meaningless question unless you ask, whose taxes? Taxes where? Taxes at what level? But the idea is to embrace us all in one great family, as if the measures that are passed by Congress apply equally to all of us, but of course they don't. We've had class legislation in this country ever since the very first Congress, ever since Hamilton's economic program was passed by the very first Congress, and the first legislation they passed was tariffs to the manufacturers, a banking partnership between the government and the government helping out private banking interests, a payoff to the speculators and bondholders, and an army ready to go out, and taxes on the poor, and an army ready to go out and collect those taxes if they refuse to pay it, as happened very shortly in the 1794 in the Whiskey Rebellion in Pennsylvania. Class legislation in a very straight line from the Hamilton economic program right up through the budget bill now being debated in Congress, right up through the oil depletion allowances of our time, right up to the enormous subsidies to the aircraft industry, which would have gone into bankruptcy after World War II if the United States government had not given enormously lucrative contracts to the aircraft industry and kept them alive. You go to the federal government when you're short of funds and ask them to keep you alive with little subsidy. The anarchists in Chicago, which might have made me really think about justice in this country, just as it made Emma Goldman think about justice when she was just a teenager in Rochester, New York, and she heard about the execution of the anarchists in the Haymarket affair in Chicago. And it galvanized her. She was never the same again. I remember that, yes, there was in the history book something about the Pullman strike. There's always something about the Pullman strike. There's always something about Eugene Debs. When you have a little bit about Eugene Debs, and that takes care of socialism, you see. You have the Pullman strike, that takes care of the labor movement. But I didn't learn anything in any of these classes about the Lawrence Textile Strike of 1912, a magnificent, dramatic episode in American history, or about the Colorado Coal Strike of 1913-1914 and a Ludlow Massacre. I had to read about that on my own. I had to listen to a song by Woody Guthrie called The Ludlow Massacre, which led me to wonder what was that about, and led me to look into that and then ask myself, how come none of this was told to me? How come the name Mother Jones never appeared in any of my history books or any of my courses? How come Emma Goldman never appeared in any of my... None of this. So I wanted to teach and write about that which I thought had been neglected. And I began to think there was a reason for neglecting that. Again, not a reason that seven people gathered in a room to plan, but a reason that comes out of the normal workings of society, of an economic system and a social system and a political system in which power and wealth are concentrated at the top. I wanted to write about history from that other point of view. I wanted to write about war from another point of view. But after I left the shipyard, or I left the shipyard in order to enlist in the Air Force. I became a bombardier in the United States Air Force, and I don't know if I should tell you what war I was in, but I should. Maybe I will, because otherwise you might think it was the Spanish-American War. but I was a bombardier in the Air Force in World War II, and I enlisted with all the enthusiasm that so many people went into World War II, because, as you know, that was the good war. Although if you look at Studs Terkel's oral history of the Good War, you'll notice it has quotation marks around it. The Good War in quotation marks. Because so many of the people he interviewed who were in that Good War came out of that war not as certain as they had gone into it. Not because they had developed an affinity for fascism. Because that was what gave us the moral purpose. That was what gave us the enthusiasm, a war against fascism. And the assumption was, a very dangerous assumption, that if the enemy is evil, then your side must be good. You see. And the enemy was evil. Yeah, I mean, the enemy was unmistakably evil, but where we made the mistake was in thinking that, therefore, our side was good. And if the enemy commits atrocities, therefore, well, certainly our side wouldn't do that. We didn't match the Holocaust. I mean, that's a unique event in World War II. But in our indiscriminate bombing of civilian populations, deliberate bombing of civilian populations, of working class populations in German cities and Japanese cities, culminating with the Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we committed atrocities. what happened in World War II was what happens in war generally, and that is whatever the initiating cause and however clear the moral reason is for the war, in which some people look better, one side looks better than the others, by the time a war ends, both sides have been engaged in evil. And so I came to the conclusion that war was an unacceptable way of solving whatever problems there were in the world, that there would be problems of tyranny, there would be problems of injustice, there would be problems of nations crossing frontiers, and that injustice in the world and tyrannies in the world should not be tolerated and should be fought and should be resisted. But the one thing that must not be used to solve that problem is war, because war is inevitably the indiscriminate killing of large numbers of people, and that fact overwhelms whatever moral cause is somewhere buried in the history of that war. And so I obviously was not going to teach about war in the same way after my experience. And I wanted to tell about war from the standpoint not of the generals and the military heroes, but from the standpoint of the ordinary guys who were in the war. Or maybe even to tell us the story of wars from the standpoint of the enemy, of the other side. How does the Mexican War look to the Mexicans? My first teaching job was at Spelman College in Atlanta, Georgia. My first real teaching job. I had a few unreal teaching jobs. But Spelman College, Atlanta, Georgia, black women's college. I went down there in 1956 and stayed there. My wife and I and our two little kids lived in a black community around Spelman College. Those were probably the most educational years of my life. Those were the years of the movement. And my students became involved in the movement, and I became involved in the movement. From Atlanta, I went down to Albany, Georgia, and to Selma, Alabama, and Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and Greenwood, Mississippi, and Jackson, and other places. Learned a lot. One of the things I learned was the capacity of human beings who seem powerless to create enormous power just by their own acts of getting together, of sacrificing together, of taking risks together. And how, against what seem insurmountable odds, things can change by people determining to change them. Because what could be a tougher situation than for black people in Mississippi or Alabama or Southwest Georgia to decide to change a deeply embedded set of social relations that had existed in those societies for a long time? And it didn't look like it could be done, but it was done. And to see that happen, and to see people who were quiet and silent suddenly speak up, people who were just going about every day doing their job, apparently, and this is what, remember, they used to say, well, people here are happy with their lives. Look at them. They're just going about their daily work. Well, one thing I learned is not to mistake silence for acceptance. Not to think because people aren't doing anything at any particular time that they're not capable of doing something an hour from now. And I could see people, you see people change. My students at Spelman College were the most controlled students. They were taught to be controlled. They were supposed to be controlled. They were the daughters of maids and laundresses and porters and sharecroppers. And they were supposed to go to college so they could lift themselves up into the black middle class and make something of themselves. The idea was to stick to their work, stick to their studies and become successful and don't get into trouble. And this college was surrounded by a stone wall and barbed wire to make sure that's where you stay, that's where you what you do. You can have your nice little, this was a kind of unspoken pact between the city fathers of Atlanta and the black colleges of Atlanta, Spelman and Morehouse and Atlanta University. And the pact was, you can have your nice Negro colleges, you can even have a few white faculty. We will even let some white people from town come to campus at Christmas time to listen to the Glee Club. But in return, don't interfere with what happens in the city of Atlanta, which at that time was as tightly segregated by race as Johannesburg, South Africa. And yes, there was that wall around the campus, and at a certain point, the students leaped over that wall and went into the city. It had been in them for a long time. It had been in them from the time, who knows at what age, or 4 or 5 or 7, or whatever age it was that they first became conscious that they were looked upon as different by society. Sometimes my students would write to me about that first time in their lives when they became conscious of the fact that they belonged to a different group that was looked on in a certain way. And one thing, white society in America has never really been able to encompass, no matter how liberal and tolerant and understanding it is, that it's been never been able to comprehend the depth of feeling, the depth of indignation and anger in people who have that history that black people have had in this country. And so when they behave in ways that are incomprehensible to us, like exulting at the, or some of them exulting, some black people exulting at the acquittal of O.J. Simpson, and say, what's wrong with them? Forgetting that the people are never reacting only to the immediate event. People are always reacting to their own lives. What I saw in the movement and what I experienced in the movement at Spelman, and then what I experienced later in the anti-war movement, because when I left Spelman, actually, I left was a kind of euphemism. How shall I put it? Fired. I was fired. We don't like to use that word. Downsized. I was definitely downsized. I used to be 6'6". Went north and was offered a job at Boston University just in time for the beginning of a big American escalation of the war in Vietnam, became involved in the anti-war movement, and then saw some of the same phenomena in the anti-war movement, that is the apparent powerlessness of little groups of people protesting against a war fought by the most powerful military machine in the world, the most powerful nation. And how could these little knots of people, 100 people gathering on the Boston Common in 1965, and a little group here and a little group there, and a petition here and a teach-in there, how could do anything to stop a war waged by this enormous power? And yet you saw the movement grow. You saw the movement grow and grow and grow, and the 100 people who met on the Boston Common against the war in 1965 become, in 1969, at another meeting on the Boston Common, 100,000 people. And something that then is reproduced around the country as, you know, perhaps 2 million people in October 1969 meet at various places around the country to protest the war, and the population has turned around. And the administrations, as powerful as they are, with all their money and all their military power, must reckon with the most important power of all, the power of people to refuse to do something that they are asked to do, the power of young people to refuse to fight, the power of soldiers who refuse to go out on patrol, the B-52 pilots who, after a while, refuse to fly a bomber over Haiphong or Hanoi, the closing of ROTC chapters because they can't get enough people to join them. A resistance which becomes a resistance of apparently powerless people but becomes widespread enough to cause the people up there to put their heads together and to take that the activities of these powerless people into consideration and to say, as they did at a certain point, we can't go on like this. We must begin to move in the other direction. And finally, of course, with the major factor being the fact unable to win militarily in Vietnam against, again, an apparently puny and powerless revolutionary national movement. But it's instructive to see this in the civil rights movement, to see this in the anti-war movement, because it coincided with what I had come to believe in studying history, and that is... It is possible at various points in history, no matter how inconceivable it is to change the policies of the people who run the country, It is possible for people to, if they are determined enough and organized enough and indignant enough and energetic enough and are willing to take enough risks, it is possible for them to do extraordinary things. And so I believe that's true today. I'm speaking at a time when there's a lot of discouragement. Most of my friends are depressed. I have begun to think it's a condition of being my friend to be depressed. Why are they depressed? Because they must believe the media. The very people who say, I don't believe the media, believe the media. The very people say, I don't believe the politicians. They all lie. Believe the politicians. The politicians in the media tell us that they're in charge, whether the Republicans have won a victory, or that they're going to turn the clock back, and that they're going to do this, and that and we believe them. Oh, they will try to do that, and they may succeed in doing it for a little while, and they may win some victories. But the fact is that they are working against a very, very powerful impulse in the American public, which has been developed over quite a period of time. And it's a very generous and good impulse, and it's the idea that democracy should be real. That democracy, yes.
You're listening to Howard Zinn, A People's History of the United States, part two of a special two-part program. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can get copies of this program and the classic Zinn books, A People's History of the United States, and You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
That the wealth of this country should be much more equitably distributed than it is. That people who want to work, people who want to work should be able to work. And if private enterprise won't give them work, then a government program must give them work. But they must, people should be guaranteed health care and a place to live and all the things that they need to live a decent life. And this is a very, very rich country. It can do this. It's interesting. You would think from reading the little, we can't afford this. Sorry, we can afford child care. We can't afford to give school lunches to kids. We can't afford to give $500 a month to a mother taking care of two kids. We don't have the money for the arts. We have to cut money for music. We just don't have it. This country with this enormous gross national product, truly gross national product, you see. Wealth, which is concentrated in a small portion of the population, which is wasted on the military budget, which goes for all sorts of purposes other than human purposes. And there's a basis there in those facts and the existence, I believe, in most American people, not all American people, but most large numbers of American people, of the sense of what is just and what is right. And I believe that's the basis for people beginning to move, people beginning to act, people to get together with other people, not to allow those people who are trying to convince us that they have it all their way. Why? Because they were elected by some